This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome everybody and our guests, Vice President Molina, Paul Streeter, for joining us today. So we'll start off by roll call and then get into the business of the day. Sorry.
So Adam Howell here, Christy Mahoney, not here, Brandon Fortenberry, here, Kate Supron, here, Tarek is not here, Karen Loparco, not here, Anthony McCabe is here, Hey DePew, I am here, David Heiner is here, Alan Miller is not here.
Oh, okay.
Oh, she's on Zoom.
All right, hey,
Chris Barth is here, Craig is here, Marcy Benda is... don't see her here. Jennifer Michael is not here.
No,
Andrea Hanlon-Mott is here. Rigel is here. Laura Taylor is not here. Jessica Withers is here. Herb Sheldon, I do not
here.
See him. Oh, Herb online. Andrew Brooks, I do not see him. Carrie Sanzone is online. Brian Goodell is here. Josh Cooley is here. We've got Jackie here, Ashley Miller is here, Mary Newhart is not here, Emily Ivory not here, Rob is here, Jamie is here, Jessica Townley, is she online? Jessica Townley, not here, Susan Perry is here.
All right.
Yeah.
Before we proceed, can I get a motion to approve the minutes from last meeting? Kate and Brian, and the minutes are, any extensions, additions, or amendments to the minutes? Seeing none, the amendments are approved, the minutes are approved. Okay, so without any further delay, I'd like to introduce Paul Streeter, who's the Vice President of Planning and Budget for Cornell, and he's going to go into a presentation on the university budget, and I'll let you take it away.
Great, thank you. Glad to be here. I'm going to try this kind of an overview of what I'm going to try to do today. Just give you a top-level overview of the university budget, what the components are, talk about a couple of elements. They asked me to speak to endowment in particular, so I'll talk a little bit about that, just how does the endowment work. So I'll run through a bunch of slides. I take questions along the way if you want, or there'll be time at the end. But if I don't cover something, I'll do my best. Feel free to ask me. I'll do my best to address it. So when we talk, do you know how this is? I'll just hold on.
Okay,
thank you.
Talk a little bit about her.
So just to kind of talk about objectives from my world, kind of two objectives in the budget world. We're trying to maintain a balanced budget over time, both for its immediate needs as well as long-term future. So a lot of our office deals with both the one-year annual budget as well as the 10-year budget outlook for spreading estimates to maintain and use it as a planning tool. And be able to enable resource investment in priority areas. Certainly the president has priorities, but every unit has priorities, and trying to have budget structures and planning tools that allow both the institution as well as individual units to think about priorities and to look ahead and plan ahead. So two types of budgets, and I'm really going to talk about the operating budget today. Glad to take questions about the capital if you want. But the operating budget, when I talk about that, those are the resources that we take in annually. We use to pay bills. So think about it as essentially the checkbook for the university in many ways. So inflows and outflows on an annual basis. The capital operating budget is kind of 1 year type of scale. Capital budget is a multi-year planning. We think about it building renewal, McGraw Hall has been something, for example, that's been on the docket for a number of years. It takes a number of years to think about what is the scope of work, how do you figure out a funding plan, how do you execute on that, both the funding plan and the building plan. So capital budget, I wasn't going to spend a lot of time unless you'd like me to, but capital budget is a multi-year plan. Operating budget is really 1 year plan. So with that, operating budget, 1 year plan, and then the next slide, capital budget, multi-year. So if we just go, keep going here to the, to give you a sense of the university budget as a whole. So this slide shows the fiscal 20, so fiscal year 2020 ends June 30, 2020, so we're in the middle of the year right now. This is the budget for the university in total. So it includes the medical college, it includes Cornell Tech, includes all operations of the university. We are almost $4.8 billion operation. That's what our budget was for the current year. And this slide shows the kind of resources that come into the institution, for the campus, for the university as a whole. So I'll note a couple things. Their single largest resource, when you look at the university as a whole, is this medical college service revenues. And what that is the medical physicians, they're clinical, it's their professional fees. So the clinicians are on Cornell's records, Cornell's books, they're employees of Cornell. They do work at New York Hospital, so they compare the in-person stays, the operation of a hospital are not on our books. That's on New York Presbyterian, but the clinicians are on our books, and as they charge out for their services, that's what's flowing through that orange box over there, and that's 30% of total university resources. Next largest is tuition and fees. Next largest tuition and fees, just about 26% for the campus as a whole. You'll see that slide will look much different when I show you the Ithaca campus in just a second. But that's the tuition that we charge to undergraduate, graduate students, the university as a whole. This is what I would call gross tuition. It's the sticker price we bill to all students on a per student basis. Financial aid is an expense, but the sticker price is what we call tuition. So that's the 25%. And I just call out for a moment here the sponsored programs. This is all our sponsored research activities. So it's restricted gifts, restricted grants and contracts money. The gift money that has a sponsored nature to it. It's restricted money in the sense that you've got to use it for a really explicit purpose. Whatever that external wanted us to use it for, that's what that activity is. And in total, that represents about 15% of our total university resources. So when you go to the Ithaca campus, remember total university was $4.8 billion, just about. Ithaca campus, we're about $2.5 billion. The medical college, almost half of the university as a whole, is the campus, obviously the other half of that. This picture here actually does include Cornell Tech. Cornell Tech is a small component, but just to be clear, it does include Cornell Tech. This $2.5 billion is a much different revenue picture for us in Ithaca. You'll see that tuition on the other slide was 25%, but here in Ithaca, tuition is a much bigger part of our resource, almost 46%. This pie, the number of slices in this pie, is actually a strength in Cornell. So it shows that we have a pretty diverse revenue stream. So there are many institutions in which they are dominated by tuition, 60, 70% or more. But Cornell is a large research institution, a good chunk. In a wealthy institution, a good chunk of our money comes from sponsored activities, same kind of thing I described on the previous slide. This is restricted activity for research. But you can see a slice here for investments. This comes from the endowment. I'll talk about that in a second. That represents about 5% of our resources here in Ithaca. Gifts. And then you get up to sales and service enterprise. This is really the campus life operation as well as campus store. So it's really external sales and services that are not part of core academic mission. And then slice about state, I'll talk about in a second. We do, as a campus, benefit from a great relationship with New York State, and financially it's a significant part of our budget. About 5%, but it's about $120 million, just the state fees alone. So So that's a picture of our revenues. I'll just pause here. Any questions on that? Just how we fund things on campus? Yes, sir.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the other sources are at 9.9%?
Sure. I often say it's everything that's not in the other slices, and I'm not trying to be flip on that. For a second, I'm really not trying to be flip with that answer. It really is everything else. So when you start thinking about it, it's taking the Statler Hotel, the Animal Hospital up at the Vet College, the Animal Health Diagnostic Center, Laboratory of Ornithology, Executive Education. So it's all these activities that are not credit-bearing, where we have to enroll students, and it's not campus-like, and it's not research. All that other kind of sales and service kind of activities, that executive education is a good part of it. So did that help?
Yeah.
So all this miscellaneous stuff is thrown under that category of other. Great question. So in the sponsored arena, we have what we call direct costs and indirect costs. The direct costs are money we get from a sponsor and we can use to carry out the research very directly. Hire staff, conduct experiments. It's the direct cost of the activity. But particularly in the federal world, there is a standard indirect cost rate, which helps pay for the overhead of running the university, whether it be utility costs. Myself, I'm overhead. I'm central administrative. I'm an overhead of the university offices like mine. For the federal government, that rate is in the realm of 60%. I'm not going to try to quote it exactly, but it's in that realm of about 60%. But this number includes things that are done for the state of New York, for foundations, for other private entities that might be sponsors for any external research. We have a negotiated rate with the federal government, which is at that 60% level, and that's pretty steady across any federal award. You start getting into some other sponsors, and there might be some negotiation there. Great, I'll go on then. So on the expense side, this again, sticking with just Ithaca, $2.5 billion in revenue, $2.5 billion in expense. We are finished. It is a surprisingly small margin for a $2.5 billion operation. We finish just about break even every year. So most of our money goes out the door, and largely is around people in space. So where do we spend our money? 54% of our revenues go towards salaries and wages, benefits of our employees. Other component around space, whether that be the utility costs, the ongoing maintenance, so this is a renovation cost, this is just maintaining our facilities in as-is condition. Debt service, so to the extent we've taken out, we've had to borrow money to do facility projects over time, that's a component of it. And as I said, utility costs. So 4% of our revenues are really tied up in people in space. And then you get into financial aid. So financial aid financial aid occurs in a couple forms. One form is that we've received endowment incomes or gifts over time that allows us to provide students with aid that is actually funded by a gift or investment income. Another component of financial aid is something we call unfunded aid, which effectively is just a discount off the tuition price. We provide aid to undergraduate students based on financial need. So in their packaging, if they demonstrate a financial need, we're going to provide an aid package to that student. From a budget standpoint, it means that we take in less cash. So it really is a discount. But in our world, we think about it as an expense. And then general expenses are everything else. Supplies, materials, conferences, travel, food, et cetera. All other kind of activity that's not personnel-based or space-based. Next, please. So I do think it's interesting for folks to understand our relationship with New York State. As I mentioned, it is a significant relationship. We are the land-grant institution from New York for New York State, and it's a status that we hold it institution-wide. Financially, it plays itself out through the four contract colleges. So CALS, ILR, Human Ecology, and the Vet College are what we term four contract colleges of the state of New York. And if you were to look in state ed law, you would see them. They were separately established at different times, noted the years here in which they were established. But they were established separately in state ed law. Cornell University is one institution, one private institution. The four colleges are clearly part of the private institution of Cornell. But from the state perspective, they are also overseeing some general oversight under the State University of New York system. So we have a relationship through the state of New York with the state as a whole. And we receive about $120 million of appropriations every year that goes to the benefit of those four contract colleges. It largely pays for salaries, benefits, maintaining facilities, et cetera. Next slide, please. And I'll come back to how we use that money in a second. I just thought, if you've never thought about it, Cornell operates in every county of the state and in the five boroughs of New York in some form. So just to give you a sense of the breadth, this was something that illustrated that a few years ago. I'm not sure if all the dots are exactly accurate, but it gives you a sense. We are all over the state through cooperative extension. All that activity is reflected in our budget. Go to the next slide, please. So this relationship with the state in terms of financial support, they do provide money in the research realm, and that's typically research that is targeted to benefit the citizens of the state of New York. A lot of work we do in the agriculture realm, Vet College, labor development through ILR, policy development through Human Ecology. From a financial standpoint, the money that I talked about, the $120 million, allows us to charge a lower tuition rate to New York State resident students who are enrolled in the contract colleges. Again, I'm not remembering the exact number. It's about an $18,000 discount, though, between the tuition rate that a student from outside of New York in one of those contract colleges would pay, or a student in arts and sciences, engineering, or architecture, art and planning would pay. So New York State resident student in one of the four contract colleges gets a significantly reduced tuition price. And that's because we get the money from tax dollar support from the state of New York in another manner. They said they provide operation support for the operations of those four colleges, partial support, not fully by any means. And they also provide us support to maintain facilities in the contract college side. So if most of the buildings on the contract college side are actually owned by the state of New York on land owned by Cornell, and the state continues that obligation. That obligation sort of manifests itself in support to maintain those buildings. So endowment funds. So what are they? They are funds that are invested. I'm just going to read it here just to be really clear. They are invested in the principal amount. The principal, that's an amount invested up front. Someone gives us $1 million gift. That million is called the principal. It is invested for the long-term intention of providing a stable flow of operating income to the university. There are components of the endowment that are truly restricted. If a donor, in my example, gave us $1 million and said, I want that to go into the endowment, we have to put it in the endowment, and we can never invade that principle. If someone gave us $1 million, we can't say 5 years from now, well, let's take out $500,000 and do such and such with it. We don't have that discretion. Legally restricted, we are bound to keep that invested in perpetuity forever. And what we benefit from is the income. So I'll show you in a minute the amount of money we have in endowment. It's a significant amount, but what we benefit from is the income. There is a component of the endowment that allows us institutions, the way we manage it, is if a unit or the university over time has had money that they wanted to invest in the endowment, again, to generate income for the long term. So the trade-off is, I have a dollar today, do I put it in the endowment or do I spend it? It's that trade-off of what are you trying to do with that? What's the purpose of that money? You're trying to support a position, a new faculty position forever. You're going to want to invest a chunk of money and take that to pay the salary forever versus spending it kind of one time and the money's gone. So the purpose of endowment is to create this asset that works for the institution, again, for the life of the institution. Most endowment funds come from donors and they're restricted for a specific purpose. Individual endowment funds are not separately invested. So we take all the endowment funds from that we receive from donors and have received over time. It's invested in one big portfolio. Lots of different investments within that portfolio, but it's invested as one portfolio. And we think about it as an asset that's one portfolio from a budget perspective. Next something? So this is just a look at last year, last fiscal year. How was that endowment income used? So the endowment's about $6.9 billion, and it generates, for the university as a whole, in a scale of $340 million or so. So how was that money used? So this is how it was used, the income from it. 29% went specifically into academic programs to support specific research out of the colleges and our research institutes. 26% supported financial aid. This could be undergraduate financial aid, graduate student financial aid, fellowships, things of that sort. 22% supported faculty positions. So we have some faculty who are in named positions, typically, not 100%, but typically a named position, a named faculty member, indicate that there's likely an endowment fund that's supporting that position. It's a tremendous benefit to a college if they have an endowment that can support a position forever versus having to find the money every year through tuition. So 22% of this $340 million roughly is goes towards professorships. And then the rest is at 20% really just goes to support general operations. Some of that very restricted, but it's to support general operations program money. Again, this is large. It's not coming to administrative activities. It's going into academic program in some form. It might be providing C-grant money for some of our institutes, and both outreach and research institutes have grant activity that they fund. Some of that's funded by endowment income. So it's going towards program activity with a small amount towards facilities support. For example, Duffield Hall, where Duffield Hall was built, the donor who Mr. Duffield, the building is named after, also provided money for the ongoing maintenance of the building by forming an endowment. So we get some money off of that every year to help maintain it and do small renovations of the building. That's an anomaly. That's not most of our buildings. But that kind of funding is out there. So just as this value goes up and down daily, but as of June 30th, 2019, end of last fiscal year, the endowment was worth $6.9 billion. This is an endowment that benefits the whole university. This isn't just the Ithaca campus. You think about it as an investment asset. There's two resources that come into it every day and over time. There's endowment gifts, so new giving flows into the endowment, and investment earnings go into the endowment. From that pot of money, we spend. Come up with a spend, we give a spending policy governed by the trustees that says how much can we spend from this endowment every year. The rough spending rule is about 5%. So there's a policy guideline, if you go into the specifics, there's a spending policy guideline governed by the trustee, but it's roughly 5% of a rolling average of the endowment. So this endowment will go up and down daily. It's invested in the market at markets you hear about on TV, the regular, you know, stock market. It's invested in private investment income. Lots of different investments there, but the value changes regularly. So we look at this in order to provide a steady flow of income. We actually look at the value of the endowment over a seven-year period. We look at that average value over a seven-year period. We spend about 5% of that average value.
quick question about the endowment. So the LTIP payout, I think historically for the past 3 years has been on the decline. Right now in fiscal year 21, it seems like it's stabilized. Do we have any sense of what the trajectory might be moving forward for the LTIP payout?
You're talking payout.
Yeah, LTIP payout.
So LTIP is a long-term investment pool. somewhat synonymous with the endowment, not exactly, but somewhat synonymous. But that is what we're talking about here, is the $6.9 million, this long-term investment pool. And what Hay's asking about, we have a payout amount, that's this box on the right, the spendable income. We pay out on a per-share basis, so the endowment, the LTIP works like a mutual fund. Every dollar in the endowment owns a share. So if you own mutual funds in your retirement programs or anything else, you own shares of a mutual fund. All endowments own shares in the endowment, and we pay out a certain dollar amount per share. And that dollar amount is, I think, $2.45 this year.
Mm-hmm.
So for every share in the endowment, we pay $2.45. And that has been going down, as you've noted. So what that goes, it's going down because two things. We are trying to get down to a 5% spending rate. We have been spending at about 5.6%, which is not sustainable. You want the endowment to be able to stay pace with inflation. But if your return, you've got two things to make that happen. You need to have positive returns that are performing well above the rate of inflation. If returns go up and down every year, and over the average, that average just works out over time. When I talk about us taking a multi-year average, where we want to get down to this 5% level. We've been just a little bit high, and we're coming down to 5%. So what you're seeing, hey, with that being flat, and we have been declining and flat, that is the trajectory that we've been on to try to stabilize the spending. We thought we were spending too much. So where we'll go from here, if I had a prediction on the trajectory, I think we're close to bottom out, if not this year, maybe next year, and then probably a slight ramp up. We're moving to this 7-year average. It was something President Pollack wisely asked us to do because it really buffers. When you look at a 7-year average, it takes a lot of the ups and downs out of the picture. So we're getting to a more stabilized picture, and I think we'll see a pretty steady pace probably after next year.
Is there
hearing out of space as well.
Is there any explanation or understanding of the Cornell Sun had some articles in the past couple of years of the, again, lower performance of the Cornell endowment vis-a-vis other similar institutions and their endowments? Is there some understanding of what, you know, what is Cornell doing differently that other schools are doing better, or?
Not something I'm really qualified to speak to.
I could speak to it briefly. I'm Joel Molina, Vice President for University Relations. We made a shift in Chief Investment Officer about 3 years ago, Ken Miranda. He has put in place a shift in strategy, which, because of the way markets work and the way that we are limited in terms of making changes, not everything is liquid. This will take years for us to be where we will be. That being said, our performance has done quite better over the last few years than we had previously. We're not anywhere near where we want to be, but certainly it's been the right progression.
That feeds into, hey, your question, what's the trajectory? So we can kind of stay on this path, and we should stabilize. And with this amount, the goal is to have a small growth up in this every year. You want it to keep pace with inflation. So think about this in terms of paying someone's salary or paying support to run a program. You want some growth in that endowment income annually to stay pace with rising cost pressures. And it just depends on performance and market value over time.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Can you speak from your perspective in regards to the affordability, especially considering tuition is such a big chunk of the university's budget? Like, is there any projection that tuition will ever become inverse, or what are the barriers basically having? How do we go from people having a part-time job on minimum wage paying for their university education to where we are today?
So it's a constant challenge, and it is a significant priority for the president and the institution to continue to invest in student assets. So I do see us continuing to make that investment. We make a really large investment in it currently. But the trade-off to your question of can we bring, take tuition the other way, reduce tuition, the trade-off is if you look at the expense side, we've got to pay people, we've got to pay for our buildings, we've got to pay for space, we've got to pay for programs. So it's the reality of managing the institution and funding the cost increases that we need to fund and needing resources to do that. So there's a trade-off in that. It's a constant, I would say it's one of President Pollack's top priorities. And we invest, we continue to be an equal-aid institution, so we're looking at the financial need and quite proud of the fact that I think it's for the lowest 3 or 4 income quintiles, the students in the category are paying less today than they were 20 years ago in terms of an average cost. So for those with need, we provide a significant aid package, and we're continually looking at that to see how we can improve it. But a complete, you know, kind of reversal of the trend on tuition, really hard to do because we've still got to keep the lights on and pay people, and we need resources every year to be able to do that, and increasing resources every year to do that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I guess the question in terms of, I know we have limited space in terms of having like buildings and stuff like that, but if you look at the university, most other things, so exponentially sort of growing, as it were, in terms of like there's always going to be new programming and university and stuff. I'm just curious if like even admissions, are we still getting higher and higher class sizes for most of the colleges for the most part?
The last couple of years, we've been flat in terms of what our target enrollment is. As North Campus comes online, we've got a plan to grow for a few years, for about 4 years enrollment, but we've got a long-term plan in terms of where we want to cap enrollment. So I would say it's just modest growth in enrollment, which again puts pressure on how do we maintain that. So it's that balance. It's a trade-off on everything. New programs versus existing programs versus student access. It's a tricky balance.
Kate?
I have a financial aid question. So just sitting with my pocket calculator, it looks like there's about, in addition to the money that comes from the endowment for financial aid, that there's about $362 million more. What is the source?
Yep, it's tuition income. So financial aid, a little bit of a funny concept to understand, but think of it as a price discount.
A price discount, so it's just if the tuition comes, if you multiply it up, if it has $1.15 billion, and you're just discounting $362 million off of that and writing that as an expense.
Effectively, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, for undergraduate, just because most of the aid, there's probably about 100, 120 million of our financial aid is in the graduate, professional and graduate,
okay.
Master's and PhD realm in different forms. For undergraduates, the financial aid is in the scale of about 280 million, mm-hmm. and our revenue for undergraduate tuition is in the scale of about 780 million. So it's we net about $500 million to run the institution.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there questions on this or a comment? So I was going to spend a little time, and you can cut me off if you want. I've been here before. There's been conversation wanting to understand the internal budget model. Everything I talked about, you go back to my comment earlier, this is in many ways like the university checkbook. What money do we have coming in, and what does it go out for? But who gets access to the resources internally is a different question. So we have a budget model. How do administrative units get resources? How much does my office get? How much does Joel's office get? How much does the College of Ag and Life Sciences get? We have a budget model that governs in a standard manner how we allocate resources internally. So I'm shifting the conversation from how do we get how much money comes into the door, in the door, and how much money we put out the door for what purpose, to now who gets control of it. So for that, it's really this internal resource model. And as I talk about it, I'm going to talk about it from the relationship of the provost to the deans and the provost to the vice president. What happens within a college or administrative unit might differ college by college. So what I'm going to talk about is that at an institutional level makes sense. Please, next slide. So a couple things to understand. Budget model, if you hear that term on campus, the budget model doesn't create any new resources and it doesn't create any new expenses. It's just saying who's going to get the money and who's going to pay the bills. But it doesn't create any new resource. And our challenge in this is aligning the resources with the cost to make sure that who's ever bearing the cost has enough resources to be able to do that, or at least has the responsibility to make choices on how to use their resources. All right, next slide, please. So, the budget model is an overview. We we've got resources that are managed centrally. So money that the provost, tell me you're from a college. Maybe I'll just get some context for the students in the audience. So from a college, and the rest, I'm assuming, are from administrative or campus life kind of operations. So Central University receives money that we pool and we distribute back out to campus. Some resources go directly to units. What our goal is to make sure that the financial responsibilities and incentives are aligned at the unit level. We are a very decentralized institution, and we want unit leaders to both have the resources and the responsibility to balance those resources and make choice on that. So we operate the budget model in a pretty decentralized fashion, and it requires kind of unit-level management to make it all work. So the structure of this, really, we have some resources that we call direct sources that flow directly to the unit. I'll highlight that in a second. Flow directly to the college, flow directly to the campus store, or the campus life, et cetera. We have some resources that we collect in the center. The provost grabs hold of those resources, and then we redistribute them. And we do that in order to balance things in the system. So tuition and financial aid are one of those things that we put that tuition out to the colleges, so it's a spendable resource. But it comes to the provost first, and we put it through a model that says this is a fair distribution of tuition. We don't want colleges competing with each other inappropriately, an incentive that doesn't make sense institutionally. So there's some things we pool at the center and then redistribute, both cost and resources. And then we have an element of the model that is this cost recovery, in which we're pushing costs around. Next slide, please. So the direct resources, if you're sitting in a unit and you have professional or graduate tuition, that tuition flows right to you. If you run a master's program, you run a PhD program, the tuition from that flows directly to the college. So remember, when I say the term unit, I'm referring to the college, not to the department. So it flows directly to the college. Invested income, when we talked about the endowment, we are shareholders of the endowment. Colleges are shareholders. Programs are shareholders of the endowment. Anyone who has invested any unit that's invested money in the endowment gets the payout that AA was referring to, $2.45 a share, comes to that unit. So it's a direct resource to the unit, gifts that are given directly to the unit. We don't touch at the center. And sponsored awards, including the indirect cost recovery, flows out. Indirect cost recovery flows to the college. The sponsored award flows to whatever unit is managing that research. It really follows the faculty member. And this notion of sales and service income, including that other income category, it flows directly to whatever unit is earning it. So we don't touch that. So there's a good chunk of our revenues that flow directly out to the units. And those units have to cover the people costs, the benefits costs, general operating expenses, including facility expenses. So there's a pressure on the unit leader to take these resources and balance it in with their ongoing operations and new investments. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, there's resources that come to the center. So tuition, undergraduate tuition, we actually pool with the center. And we pool the financial aid to go with it, because it goes back to your question. The revenue is about $780 million, the financial aid is about $280 million. So we have about $500 million to distribute, and we push that back to the colleges, and we do that on the basis of where students are enrolled and where they're being taught. So we have a metric on that that we use. The metric could change over time, but it's a 40% follows enrollment, 60% follows teaching. But we distribute that tuition back out to the colleges, largely the provost control. And that's to keep the system balanced, if you will. State appropriations go just to the contract colleges, and the provost controls that. Next slide, please. And then there's a set of costs. So when we talked about overhead, Andrew's question earlier about overhead, there are a set of central institutional costs. So think of Day Hall and everything that kind of comes off the operations that start at Day Hall. We are institutional costs. We don't have revenues coming in to support that operation. We take those costs and we bill it out to those units who actually do have the revenues. So you've got to have back to the question on how do we keep everything balanced. The revenues have got to cover the costs. And the way we operate, it says that this is ongoing costs of running the university, then we're going to apply that against the revenues. And we do that just through a cost distribution model. We do the same thing with facility maintenance costs. And then the last little bit, the provost keeps a 10% of income to have some strategic money at the center. And that allows the provost and the president to invest in priorities, partner with deans or vice presidents in priorities. So it's a little bit of flexible money that allows the provost to keep the system balanced, if you will, and if it has a small amount of money to make investments. So that's a really, really quick overview of the budget model. I've been here before on it, but I know this group turns over, so I just wanted to touch upon it and at least invite questions if you have that. But next slide, I think that might be it. So that's it. So what didn't I talk about that you'd like to know?
Questions for Paul? Hey.
Thank you so much for coming. I feel like every time you come here, you answer a lot of really great questions and provide a lot of great, really great feedback. A question that I have, it brings me back to the president's address to staff. Somebody asked us a question about the recession, what changes have been made, what has the university done in preparation for future financial impacts of the university from another recession, and I know that the president mentioned that Joanne was overseeing a team of administrators to look at lessons learned, and it sounds like there was a lot of work underway. Is there any way you can speak a little bit more to that?
Sure. So let's go back to the moment of the recession, maybe just put a little context around it. When we had the recession, a lot of things changed for us. The endowment lost about 20% of its value at that time, so our ability to pay out that income stream that flowed off of the endowment. Maybe, could you go back to one of those early pie charts? One more, please. So, right there, thank you. So, we lost 20% of the value that immediately hit that revenue stream. It was hurtful to us. Sponsored program money actually, during the time of the recession, went up a little bit because the federal government was trying to stimulate the economy. So, we saw a change there. We saw a drop in state appropriations of about 20%. So that's a real cash loss that we had to adjust operations. We went through hiring freeze, early retirement program. So we had some things happen to us that really affected operations, and we had to adjust the size of our operations accordingly. Joanne did run, our executive vice president, chief financial officer, Joanne DiStefano, held a retreat last summer. We have one, a second session, I think, coming up next week on it, to think about the lessons learned and how could we be prepared for it. Some of it is back to the payout policy, as an example. We used to do this on a three-year average, which leaves you much more susceptible to an immediate drop. That's good if you're going to feel that pain. We've now looking at a seven-year average to smooth these kind of impacts of up and down. So I'd say that's one strategy. Another thing that impacts us, actually Joel made some reference to it in talking about the endowment, is just whether it be the endowment or the university resources, how we have our money invested and how quickly you can get at it in times of a recession, depending on how sharp it is. We put greater thought to that. I think the way the endowment's invested, the way our treasury operation thinks about managing our money and where we have access to cash if we needed it, we just learned some lessons through that process and we managed differently. So there's been an ongoing set of lessons learned and that I think we've responded to over the last 7-8 years. But should a recession happen, we're susceptible to the potential drop in state appropriations, depending on what's happening on the state budget, susceptible to a drop in the endowment value, depending on what's happening on in the market. And then that in turn affects this income stream. And we're also susceptible to student need. So the other thing that happened big in the last recession is family incomes went down. And our aid packaging, because it is needs blind, we respond to that. Our family income goes down, unemployment went up, family income goes down, and our financial aid took off as a big increase because we're responding to financial need. Financial need went up in response to the economy. So we're vulnerable, if you will, on both endowment and financial aid. We, I think, understand it a lot better and can see, we think we'll be able to see it happen, see it coming towards us sooner, and we'll make choices around that.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on Hayes' question, you mentioned some budgeting investment strategies with that, or some lessons maybe learned from the recession. Are there any operational or structural things that we're doing? I mean, I guess one budgeting thing, a reserve fund or any type of emergency fund that is being contributed to, or an identification of non-essential anything that that would be prioritized should the budget need to be adjusted in the event of a downturn?
We think about contingency much more formally now.
Right.
If we started planning a contingency, it wouldn't be at the scale that could handle a recession.
Right.
But we are building that now formally in the budget. So, we are responding to it. Just going to take a while to get to the scale that would make a that could truly buffer a downturn. But it would help us in part, so we do have some contingency we planned on that. Again, I think the shift of the new budget model, we're talking about this 8-10 years ago, and I say one of the things is we have a lot to learn, and there's a lot of surprises. I don't think we would have the surprises in today's world. So I think that we've made a large investment, I think, in understanding what happened in the recession, and you kind of pull one thread and watch a bunch of other threads start to unravel. I think we see that a lot better, so we're in a much better position to manage through it, and I think to make choices and understand the implications of that. But I think we would still be faced with some level of choice. I don't think it would be as severe as last time. We had the rug kind of pulled out all at once, and we were really in an exposed position with capital projects. We control capital activity a lot differently than we did back 10 years ago, so we don't start a project without having all the money in hand accounted for, and we had some exposure last time on that. So I think we're in a much better prepared position and don't face the same scale of risk.
Well, I've been here 3 years, and, you look around and I say, wow, we invest a lot of resources in gifting, soliciting gifts. And I say, now I'm starting to see that where, a lot of the endowment money comes from the gifts. So now I can start to see, wow, no wonder that's an important component is building up that pot and getting people to give.
Absolutely. I think it's a difference maker on the margin. So we operate with a $2.5 billion operation on revenue, $2.5 billion on the expense. So our operating margin is really slim. If we want to do something really innovative and new, it's often seeded with gift money. It's that enabler to try to start doing something different. It is the resource for the endowment. We're spending from the endowment to continue to grow it. It comes from gifts going into the endowment. So new endowment giving, typically on the scale of about $150 million a year into the endowment. And then gifts are about 10% of our operating budget for the campus. So it's a small slice, if you will, but in my mind, it's the difference maker on the margin.
I have a greater appreciation for what they all do.
Really important, and it's really important, I think, to the lifeblood of the institution in terms of innovation and creativity, that the giving spurs a lot of that. It's really hard to do if you're just maintaining core operations.
Brian?
So deferred maintenance for those maintenance systems beyond its useful life, and once it gets beyond that useful life, we start thinking about it as a deferred maintenance, a planned maintenance, an unfunded maintenance, whatever you want to call it, lots of terms around it, the maintenance need of some sort. So we have that. We've got a large building stock with a large amount of old buildings. So you're absolutely right, there's a deferred maintenance need out there that we don't fund at the level that would be that would eliminate it. So I would say, how are we responding to that? We understand. Go back to the question, my response earlier. We understand that a lot better. So facilities, my office, we were responsible for capital planning, capital budget side of it. So how much resources do we put towards maintenance activity? And we work really closely with facilities, and then together we work really closely with units to prioritize it. We'll never wipe out deferred maintenance. Way too big a number, and actually would be an disproportionate use of resources to prioritize building so much more than people and program. But we've got some catch up to do on that, and that's that trade-off of constantly doing it. So there's a lot of planning effort that goes around it. Student Campus Life is just coming out with some thoughts about how do they maintain their housing stock over time. And in turn, we're thinking from a resource standpoint of how do we enable them to do that budgetarily. This is a 30-year kind of plan. We're seeing that in pockets all around campus. But it's trying to make targeted investments where we can. And in honest, from my seat, we're trying to influence when a unit says, I want to renovate, you know, the fourth floor of the physical science building. We want facilities at the table saying, when you do that renovation because you want to rearrange the space, you've got to take care of the plumbing that's running through the space and the electrical. So we're trying to influence these things, so we're investing in maintenance as we do small things, not just wait for the big building renewal. But it's a constant challenge. And so to answer your question, how are we doing that? We're trying to, every year, put a little bit more towards that, and then a better job of prioritization and influencing how we Yeah. So we have a 10-year capital plan. We never had one before, so I didn't put it up here, but we've got a list of the projects that we're prioritizing over the next 10 years, and we've got a funding plan for those projects that are a combination of operating budget resources that we commit to maintenance, so take it out of operations and say we've got to use this for maintenance. A combination of gift money, so renovating the Raw Hall and some other projects are partly dependent on philanthropy, and then an allocation of debt. So we went through the recession. After the recession, we had a moratorium. The university didn't borrow any money for about 10 years, about 8 to 10 years. And that was because our financial position was really hurt. We lost the endowment value. So we had a debt moratorium for 8 to 10 years. I don't remember the exact time frame. We're just loosening that up. The North Campus project is funded with debt. And now we're just being very, very targeted on how we use debt. It's not open to every unit. We've got a very controlled list of projects, and all those projects have a maintenance need. So I just think we're paying more attention to it. Not a great answer to your question, but we're paying more attention to it, and I think we'll start moving this needle on it. Did you have a question?
No.
I think we're about out of time. Okay, all right. Well, last question with Kate.
Okay, my question was on maintenance as well. Just, I actually have several, but I'll pick one. Am I correct that I've heard that new construction has to have the funds to endow the maintenance over time as part of the fundraising effort?
I would say that's an aspiration. It's not a policy.
It's not a policy.
Yeah. If we could, we would love to. It's not a policy. We don't start the project without knowing how we're going to pay for the maintenance and maintain it over time, to Brian's question a little bit.
The maintenance itself is not endowed.
But the maintenance, we don't have that as a policy requirement. Many of our buildings are not funded with gifts, so there's no opportunity to do that. To the extent the building is funded with gifts, we seek that, but I would say it's an aspiration, not a policy requirement.
So if our members have questions after the fact, we can follow up with you. And
absolutely. Yep.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your presentation. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So let's move on to committee reports. Executive committee, hey.
Hi, everyone. So we are continuing work on transitioning documentation for providing resources to the next executive team, whoever they should be, in order to ensure their success. We're working with units across campus on a Greg Eales, commemoration or own award. So that is on the horizon. And nothing new for now. We have up in our next meeting on the calendar a CCET forum debate, which I think we should discuss the handling of that.
I think we're going to talk about the
afterwards. So we'll discuss that in a little bit. And I think in April we're going to try to arrange for a presentation on the North Campus expansion and try to get that on the calendar in May. We're going to leave some time open for regrouping and for any other housekeeping items for end of the year discussion and review. So that's the the executive committee update. Things are in progress.
Any questions for Hehe? All right, let's move on to communications. Carrie, are you with us? Hello.
Hey, everybody. We met Friday, not at our normally scheduled time, but one of our Tuesdays. We reviewed the content, draft content for our next newsletter, and made some tweaks and got some additional stuff in there. We've got a committee feature on education. We've got a member feature on Ellen. Recent resolutions, George Peter Award rollout, the CARE Fund, a promotion focusing on getting contributions, and an election heads up. So we've got a lot going on in there. We talked about the rollout for the George Peter Award. Jackie showed us our samples that just came in for our promotional items, so we are whittling that down. And we had a pretty robust discussion about the lunch concept, and got some feedback from Cheryl on the GRC. I know Brandon is going to be getting some information on possible discount or special menu items, so we can do a pilot of that sort of lunch get-together type of event. Separately, I have provided Jessica with a template for the election mailing, so she's working on that, and she'll probably work on that, and a content template, couple other
details.
Hopefully that's in good shape. That's all I have.
Any questions? All right. Let's move on to, is Marcy here? Employee Education, is she with us online? No? Okay. We'll just move on. And Christy's not with us either. For
she's scheduled the next meeting for Friday, 3:30 B in NBR from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m.
Awesome. Well, you can just go right into your committee report too then.
Well, I scheduled our next meeting for the 17th of March, right here in this room, 10:30 to 11:30. We're going to continue discussion on the bereavement policy. I have met with some various people and we want to give updates on that. And we've had action items for the team, and we're going to get connected to where we're at and other things. I'm going to follow up on the gender equality discussion. I'm going to follow up on the election day time off policy that we talked about at the meeting. And any new business. And then just want to see what we're doing.
Any questions for Brian for the Benefits and Policy Committee? Seeing none, we'll go into the Elections Committee. Jessica?
So, yes, I am working on the template from Carrie. And the heads up will be in the March newsletter. We met last week. Meetings are scheduled for the rest of the semester. And I just thought I would also mention that I did listen carefully last week as we were talking about seats and the right number and who should be represented. And so I followed up with Gina, and Jamie and I are going to meet just to like explore some ideas. I cannot fit any more into my 39-hour week, but we can at least have some discussion about it and what might happen next.
And that's something I would mention for everybody. If there are ideas or great things that you couldn't get to in your committees, we can always put it in a final report and leave it for the next folks that come after us, or for those of you who will be here next year. So that's something to keep in mind. Thanks, Jessica. So moving into open discussion, the reason we have an actual really important thing to that we on the executive committee wanted to put to the members, because as you all know, there are only a few meetings left in the year, and we have a lot of important topics coming up that our time needs. But as you also all know, there is an employee elected trustee election occurring, as well as an important candidate debate that is coming up. What we want to get your feedback on is the option of either holding that candidate debate during our next meeting, or essentially taking the time of our next EA meeting to hold that debate so that the lunch hour is available for those who want to witness and be a participate in that debate. That would be on the 17th. Is that our next meeting?
18th,
I'm sorry. And then essentially it would be held from 12 to 1, and we would have an abbreviated meeting directly thereafter, or we would request that our meeting time not be taken for that and the candidate debate be held separately. We do have a couple competing things. It's important that you all have the opportunity to witness the debate, and it dovetailing our meeting onto it or attaching our meeting onto it gives you all that opportunity. But at the same time, we have a lot of important issues that we need every minute to discuss, things like inclement weather, things like, you know, there's talk of maybe having somebody come and speak to us about the coronavirus preparations and things like that. So I wanted to get your feedback before we work with Gina to make that decision. Thoughts? Questions?
When would it be if it's not during our meeting? And if it is during our meeting, is it open to...
I guess I actually framed it wrong. If it's during our meeting, it's not our meeting. This is a separate process. The candidate election, the trustee candidate election and debate is not an EA administered thing. So I don't run anything. We don't have any preference. We don't have any special privileges on questions. In fact, are there community questions that can be asked? So it is, our meeting starts directly after and would be a half hour. If it's not held during that, I don't know. Gina, did you have alternative dates that you had scouted out, or is it?
No, the trustee debate will happen at that time.
Regardless. Okay.
What we were trying to do when I first approached the exec was maximizing an already interested body. And depending on, at the time, we didn't know how many candidates there would be, so it was sort of a little loose. Now that we know, we have 5 great candidates. Just doing the math, it'll take about an hour, and we want to make sure that we can use the noon to 1, the traditional lunch hour, so that we can engage the staff community who might want to participate remotely or in person. So it would mean the model that we're proposing, if it works for you all, is starting the meeting at noon, which would be the first hour would be the trustee debate, and then just sticking around for that 1 o'clock to 1:30, which is the regular time for the EA, the trustee debate would end, and you would just convene the meeting and have a shortened meeting to do your business.
The other option is possibly that if you all were amenable to it, we could extend the time of our meeting after that if we felt it necessary. That's taking a lot of people's time, though. Andrea?
Where would the debate be held? In this room?
No, in a different space.
I was going to say, I didn't think this room would accommodate.
Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? Because that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, Gina. Essentially, if you wanted to see the debate, you'd have to skip this meeting if we held our meeting at a different time. So, Craig?
Will the debate not be recorded?
It will be.
So you can see it afterwards. That's true. That's a good point.
Will the EA meeting after that be in the same location?
Could be.
I think that we would, yeah, just for logistical reasons, not shuffle everybody to a different place.
We're confirming that. It'll be central campus. It'll be a space that we typically use, accessible. We're looking at several different ones right now.
The second we know, we'll put it out there, everybody.
So my thought with that is if we have a meeting in the same location as the debate, there'll be other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have to kind of wait for people to clear out in order to have that meeting. How does that work?
It's an open meeting. All EA meetings are open, and in fact, one of the rationale points was, especially with the EA elections coming up, this is a great opportunity to engage the staff community that would have been there for either part of this,
mm-hmm.
to really get involved with some of the elections that are going on.
Probably I would open the meeting welcoming those guests of the trustee debate to join us or stick around as constituents of the EA. Kate?
I would support fully having the
And I think it's also a nice opportunity for outreach for the EAs. And I don't know what people's schedules are like in terms of spending.
The other thing I would mention is, you know, Carrie and the communications committee have deployed tools to for all of us to give feedback on issues. We have the box, we have email. I mean, there are lots of important issues. I don't want to downplay that at all. So we may need to consider that we'll have to be engaged on those outside of our regular meeting time, around this issue. It looks like there's somebody on check. Can anybody? I don't know. I just want to make sure nobody's trying to ask a question and we're ignoring them. Anyone else? Thoughts? Contrary thoughts to having it to combining the two or bracketing the two, I should say.
I have a thought.
Hi, Carrie. Yeah, go ahead.
Hey. So I actually really like the idea of putting the two things together. I think it's great and. We can maybe get some more people interested, like Gina said. I know Christine and I had discussed maybe introducing. We've been working with a few of the others on a draft inclement weather resolution. I just want to make sure that we're going to have time in the schedule for this semester to have a good discussion on it. So. I was hoping to introduce it that meeting.
I think for my part, Carrie, I mean, we do have presentations and things like that, but the actual business of the EA will always prioritize that first in terms of, like, resolutions and issue debates. You never know how debate's going to go or how a discussion's going to go, but I can guarantee that we will make every possible effort to give as much oxygen to these important EA issues as possible and give them priority. And again, I encourage, as resolutions come out and things like that, that people really utilize offline when you have time to review them, ask sponsors questions, ask committee chairs questions, things like that. Use the issue portal that Carrie's put out there. Other questions? I mean, right now it sounds like we will proceed with the next EA meeting being...
Should we vote?
We can vote, yeah. Actually, that's a good point.
Before you vote, may I just quick say something real quick? Please don't feel any pressure. If it would disrupt the business that you're here to do, vote your conscience. It's really, there's other options that we can... It seemed like a great idea. And I think the idea of making sure that everybody feels that it's a great idea is right. So if it's not what's great for the good of the good, the trustee debate we'll do our own thing.
Why don't we just, I would move that we vote on the question of whether to have the meeting combined with the candidate trustee debate or not. All those in favor of having our meeting with alongside the candidate debate, raise your placards. Opposed? It looks like we will be hosting it with the candidate debate. And thank you all for... I'm sorry, Rob.
I just say, in terms of... I'm assuming that there could be, like, time constraints, like, in terms of the debate and things like that.
It's very structured.
Okay.
Yeah. We've had timers in the past, depending on how many candidates and who they were. Hopefully, we'll... And it'll be moderated, but yes, I think we're 56 minutes.
As soon as they, we'll send around all the details to everybody because not everybody's here, and as soon as all the details of the details will go public or something or whatever, we'll make sure that everybody's well informed as soon as everything is worked out. But I appreciate everybody giving their feedback because our work is important. And making sure that everybody's aware. This debate is important. I think we can all work around it and get a lot out of both our meeting time and the debate. So thank you. We have a few minutes if there are any other issues that folks want to bring up.
Yeah,
Brandon.
Maybe it's just a point understanding of where I might be able to bring this. The conversation came up today with some of my organization about about performance dialogues and the efficacy and the time, energy, and utilization of time to do these performance dialogues on a regular basis. You know, I can go through a diatribe of feelings and emotions about all of them, but the basic idea was, you know, questioning that process. Is it an effective use of leaders in our organization's time and managers? What is the net value for groups and organizations? And how would we address that conversation overall as to whether or not the university should really take a deeper dive into how they do that process? So just that's my 30-second elevator speech about a thought and idea. I want to see if anybody has any input.
My input, CIC has moved away from performance dialogues. So they're basically, with the SIP is, you know, there's no, everybody was getting rated like a 3, no matter what, whether you were a 5 or a 1, everybody was a 3. And that got like mixed messages and alignments with your 3 is equal to your SIP. So overall, CIC is no longer really going through, you have your own performance review, but it's the manager's expectations through one-on-one to keep their employees on track. So the arbitrary process has functionally been mostly eliminated. So I would like to know more from other people's units and areas how it's going for you guys.
Josh.
On the flip side of that, we do it for 200 union members that have no benefit or impact for them at all.
So, really?
Yes. Tradespeople, they're a union contract.
Yeah.
They get no, they get their negotiated raise. It gives us an opportunity to sit down with them for a few minutes, but I believe an effective manager is doing that throughout the course of the year anyway. So I manage 25 people. I'm doing 25 of them.
Yeah, that was
all. It was 36.
That's a big part of the conversation, is the tie of it to any income-based interest is very, very loose and in most cases not applicable even on a managerial level, that it's not tied to that. And that in additionally, if it's a non-performer, it's not ever used as a disciplinary document. It can't be a disciplinary document because it's a performance dialogue. The disciplinary documents are disciplinary documents. So it just seems like a system that has been in place for a long time, and the conversation was, you know, do people expect that sort of feedback, and that's what they're looking for, that yearly feedback, as opposed to in time, real managerial things happening.
Just like somebody online.
I want to add a comment. It's just that sometimes the performance dialogue is the only time that a supervisor manager connects with their employees. In that case, it's necessary. But hopefully, most are keeping in touch on a regular basis, so it shouldn't be a long or difficult process.
Yeah, Brian.
I'm kind of concurring with Josh here because I ask to represent union employees. And I have some union employees that value that kind of dialogue, and I have others that waste my time. I will tell you this, that when the dialogue process started up, I was more in favor of it because of the, I thought it would be a valuable thing, not only for to give dialogue, but to receive dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I was worried about the abuse mechanism. What's going to stop an employee from being abused by a supervisor because the supervisor just didn't like them. And you perform your expectations, but the supervisor had conflict. So I thought it gave a lot of power to some people, and I don't know if that power should have been there. I will tell you this, that I agree that the dialogue should happen year round. It shouldn't be, oh, guess what, we gotta go meet for the first time this year. It should never be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happening in a lot of areas, and I think that needs to stop. And I think there's an educational component with the dialogue that has to be addressed as well. I think that there has to definitely be more training on how to do about dialogue if we're going to continue to maintain it.
We're out of time. I think it's an issue that merits more discussion, though, Brandon, if you want to pursue it. But I'm going to have to ask for a motion to adjourn right now, if I can. Motion from Tony. Second by Jamie. All right. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.